Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. EPA to roll back Obama-era methane rules. The Trump administration has proposed weakening requirements for testing and repairing methane leaks in drilling operations, among other measures, in a step toward rolling back an Obama-era policy to combat climate change. Methane, the primary component of natural gas, leaks from oil and gas wells during drilling. It accounts for 10% of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions, but has more than 80 times the heat-trapping potential of carbon dioxide in the first 20 years after it escapes into the atmosphere. The proposed changes, among other measures, would give drillers a year to do leak inspections instead of just 6 months and 60 days to make repairs instead of 30. California Governor Jerry Brown used the spotlight of a global climate change conference to excoriate the Trump administration for rolling back restrictions on releasing methane, calling the reversal insane. It borders on criminality, Brown said to applause from an international audience of climate experts and government officials gathered in San Francisco. I think Governor Brown is correct. Money taken from FEMA given to ICE. As Puerto Rico's death toll climbed from 64 to 2,975 in Hurricane Maria, and we now face Hurricane Florence less than 48 hours away from making landfall on the southeast coast of the United States with anticipated catastrophic impacts, we learn that budget documents show the Trump administration stripped $10 million from FEMA over the summer and gave it to Immigrations and Customs Enforcement. The money was used to help detain and deport undocumented immigrants, as well as to fund detention centers. A spokesman for the Department of Homeland Security said none of the money came from disaster relief funding and called the timing of the criticism as a massive hurricane approaches the East Coast a sorry attempt to push a false agenda. Budgets are numeric indicators of priority. It is not a false agenda to highlight the fact that the Trump administration took money from the agency charged with protecting Americans during a time of crisis to fund an agency to help manage an administration-managed and manufactured crisis. Pope calls for global clergy sex abuse summit. Pope Francis is calling for a worldwide summit on clergy sex abuse. The Pope today summoned bishops from around the world to the Vatican this February to discuss how to stop clergy from sexually abusing children. The summit is believed to be the first of its kind. Some members of the clergy have been carrying out sexual abuse for decades. An investigation in the U.S. earlier this year found that over 1,000 children were abused by clergy in Pennsylvania over the course of decades. Clergy sex abuse scandals have also been reported in Germany, Ireland, Australia, Argentina, and Chile. How tone deaf is the Pope? This is not an issue of how to stop clergy from using Vatican email for personal use or how to stop priests from going to Hialeah dog track to bet on greyhounds. The church really doesn't get it. Here are the first two parts of the answer. One, make public the names of those priests who the church has found guilty of the crime of sexual abuse. Make public the names of those who have been accused and the status of the investigations of them. And two, create a PAC whose purpose is to eliminate the statute of limitations on child sex abuse. Make it consistent with murder. You're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For many people, the military-industrial complex brings to mind the top 20 weapons manufacturers. Today, it might well be called, according to my guest, the military-industrial congressional almost everything complex. What does this mean for America going forward? For this, we turn to my first guest, an author and political scientist with an extensive teaching and publishing career, the Professor Emerita at Keene State College in Keene, New Hampshire. She joins us to discuss her op-ed, The Political Economy of the Weapons Industry, Guess Who's Sleeping with Our Insecurity Blanket. She is Dr. Joan Roelofs. Welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thank you.
So, first of all, fantastic piece. Counterpunch is where I found it. Great, great piece. Give us a little background. What new developments did Eisenhower see coming out of World War II in the American political economic landscape that prompted him to warn the public about the conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry?
Well, I'd like to give a few quotes from his farewell address in January 1961.
Please do.
America's leadership and prestige depend not merely upon our unmatched material progress, riches, and military strength, but on how we use our power in the interests of world peace and human betterment. Then he went on to say, the conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We must guard against unwarranted influence by the military-industrial complex. He also said that there is a danger that the free university will become dominated by federal employment and contract research by scholars, and that public policy could become captive of a scientific technological elite. And he said, disarmament is an imperative. Another war could destroy civilization. He also knew of the plan to nuke the Soviet Union to oblivion. I would add to that that business at the time feared a depression if military production were drastically reduced. And also in those days, it was hard to get elected to Congress if one were not a veteran. So Congress was full of veterans, most of whom thought well of the military. And this is what Eisenhower was up against, both a business elite and a Congress full of military supporters.
So you write that the weapons industry may be spearheading the military budget and military operations. It is aided immensely by the cheering or silence of citizens and their representatives. So how has the cheering or silence contributed to the problem, and what are the likely reasons for that cheering or silence?
Well, I have four reasons. There are probably a lot more. One of them is that people are silent because of a culture of militarism, which has been reinforced by history in the schools, by government propaganda, by the media, computer games, 4th of July parades, and other things. So there is actually a glorification of the military in the whole history of our country, including, of course, the extermination of the Native Americans has been glorified in our history as a great thing.
In fact, let me just throw one more thing in there, because a lot of people don't realize, as this whole Colin Kaepernick conversation and the boycott and the protest, what a lot of people don't realize is the Army bought into the NFL in order to promote the Army during the beginning of the game and halftime. So what we see in terms of all this display of Americana and all of that was really marketing by the U.S. Army as they wanted to influence American psyche.
Absolutely. There's many, many parts of the media. I can't go into all the details, but
sure.
So much of the media has government propaganda for the military and even military recruiting, recruiting in the schools, recruiting of children. That's one part of it. But that's not the only reason for the silence.
Mm-hmm.
Another reason is because of fear, because people are afraid of offending the people in power. They don't want to rock the boat. And some people are just don't want to know about the enormous risks facing the world. They don't want to even think about it. Another reason why people are silent is because of distractions. And some of these are urgent family matters, but also electronic entertainment. For some, it's getting food on the table, hobbies, volunteer work, and the many causes that are not threatening to the powerful. The many ways that people are distracted into worthy causes,
mm-hmm.
but they are not looking at this enormous risk and perhaps one of the most important causes. The other reason, which is what I detail in my work, is because people are silent because they have so many have interests connected to the military. Investments, for example. Many people's investments are in military stocks, and often they don't even know about that because they're investing in Vanguard and Fidelity and those companies, which are very heavy into military. Small businesses get contracts. Jobs are dependent on, so many jobs are dependent on military contracts. People have family members who are veterans who are employed by the military. And then there's a vast extent of weapon industry philanthropy, which supports the arts, which supports children's organizations, diseases, you name it. It's an incredible, of course, universities and many, many organizations of minority people in this country are heavily supported by Lockheed, Boeing, and others of that sort.
Now, you've just articulated and explained how the military buys into the public sector. You, in your piece, talk about today it might as well be called the military-industrial congressional almost everything complex. But talk about the types of businesses that figure in to the DOD budget. You talked about how the companies buy into the public sector through their philanthropy. But what a lot of people don't really realize is how much of their tax dollars is going into private sector business with military contracts.
Yes. Well, in the private sector, private businesses, not only the weapons makers, but huge contracts go to the intelligence outfits, to construction companies, which are building and renovating military bases both in the United States and throughout the whole world. Information technology firms, logistics, including things like transportation and food, medical institutions, drug companies, environmental mitigation businesses. They have very large contracts, but it turns out that almost any kind of business gets something from the military contracts, like book publishers, landscapers, childcare centers, clothing, real estate. It's quite amazing how many different kinds of businesses get something. A very good book about the consumer businesses is Nick Turr's book called The Complex.
That is a fantastic piece, a fantastic piece. We just have a couple minutes left, and I really wanted you to hit what has happened to organized industrial labor and what is its role in weapons manufacturing?
Well, many consumer industries have moved overseas. But weapons and related high-tech firms are still prospering here. They're a major source of our manufactured exports. So workers in these firms and their subcontractors are among the remaining unionized ones. They're well paid, and their campaign contributions support the continuation of their work. These are, the metal workers, the steam fitters, the old industrial manufacturing industries.
Mm-hmm.
where workers are doing well, and they don't challenge the military industry either, or militarism.
You know, to that point, as we wrap this up, a lot of people just don't understand that before World War II, we did not have the arms industry that we have now, and that as a result of the war, I mean, for example, Chrysler made the Jeep and Chrysler made tanks. They went from making consumer goods and consumer automobiles to making military products. Boeing made passenger aircraft and went then into making military aircraft. And that once those profits were realized, it was no turning back.
Yes. And of course, Boeing still makes both kinds.
Right.
There are some military industries that really do mostly military, like General Dynamics, which also has a subsidiary that makes drones.
When I bring you back, we're going to have to get into the whole privatization of the military through companies like Blackwater and other types of organizations, because now the United States is sending private army mercenaries around the world to engage in activities that used to be reserved for the quote-unquote military.
Yes, and there are also contracts for both the production of weapons and even intelligence services and other things that go to foreign companies all over the world, so that they create lobbies for the military in those countries also. I mean, it used to be said that, you know, every congressional district had some part of the F-35, but now parts of the F-35 are made all over the world.
In fact, that's leading to the problem, part of the problem with Syria, because Syria is involved in the F-35, and that's a huge, huge problem between the United States and Syria. We're going to have to take that up at another time. Dr. Joan Roloffs, thank you so much for your time. Your piece is in Counterpunch, and greatly, greatly appreciate you joining us today. The political economy of the weapons industry, guess who's sleeping with our insecurity blanket? Dr. Joan Roloffs, R-O-E-L-O-F-S. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Hey, folks. You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. What is the evangelical case against Judge Kavanaugh? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's a Baptist minister in Durham, North Carolina. He is Pastor Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove. Welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Good to be with you.
Let me ask how you're doing with the pending storm down in Durham. I hope all is well with you and your congregation.
The storm is on the way, but folks are prepared, and we're gonna pray that its damage is minimal. But you know, the poor are always hit the worst by these things, and so we're, you know, trying to listen closely to who's in the flood zones and, you know, who needs to get out.
Got you. Understood. Thank you. You write that your faith compels you to challenge the way reactionary conservatives have hijacked your faith to serve their narrow interests. How so?
Well, if you watch how this story's been told mostly in the news, it's women's rights groups, it's civil rights groups, it's folks who are concerned about gun control who've raised the alarm about Judge Kavanaugh. And on the other hand, as the way the story's been told, evangelicals are supposedly excited that they're finally getting this so-called conservative justice who will tip the scales of the court. I think that's a result of the way the religious right has really exploited evangelical faith for the last 40 years. And so what I tried to do in that piece was to look back at the origins of the religious right and to see how this political use of evangelical faith was really galvanized by the fight against the Equal Rights Amendment and by the segregation academies of the 1970s and the way that the IRS cracked down on them, and they began to organize to fight back. So that movement has convinced a great number of, I think, you know, people of general goodwill that they're somehow voting their faith when they vote for people who will back conservative judges. When, as a matter of fact, I think if you look at the concerns of Scripture and the prophetic call to care for the vulnerable, the widows, the orphans, the immigrants, these are the people who stand to lose most if our Supreme Court is dominated by people who've been approved by the Federal Society.
I don't remember if I asked you this the last time you were on. If I do, please forgive me and hopefully still answer the question. I'm glad you made that last point, because one of the things that I've been saying for a very long time is I don't understand how you can be a Republican and be a Christian. Did we talk about that before?
Well, a little bit, but I'm glad to talk about it again. I'm always glad to repeat myself.
Well, because you just raised that last point, because the fundamental elements of being a Republican are self-actualization and focus on the individual. And the fundamental tenets of Christianity are the benefits of the collective and being my brother's keeper. So I see those two things as being just opposite. Can you help me with that?
I think the what the religious right was very effective at doing.
Well, let me ask you, is that a legitimate question?
Sure, it's a legitimate question.
Okay.
I think a lot of people are genuinely confused when they just read what Jesus actually said and look at what Christians do in Jesus' name in the public square. I think there's a genuine disconnect. I think that's why a lot of millennials don't have any interest in the church, because they've just seen too much hypocrisy. So, sure, it's a legitimate question. But it has a history. The parties as they are today are not what the parties always were, right?
Correct.
Republicans always want to claim that they're the party of Lincoln. They've come a long way from Lincoln. When black folks first got the right to vote in the South, you couldn't find one who wasn't a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the party of today, right? So what's, I think, crucial to look at is who the parties have aligned with, what interests have they aligned with, because in politics, we're always talking about competing interests. And frankly, when I look at the Republican Party today, it seems to me that they've aligned themselves with the corporations and with folks who are wanting to make money off of war. And that, it seems to me, is the opposite of the interests that God calls us to be concerned about when we, when we hear the prophetic call to, woe unto those who legislate evil and rob the poor of their rights, Isaiah says.
Didn't Jesus throw the money changers out of the temple?
Threw the money changers out of the temple.
So would we consider then the arms industry and the banksters that so many of the conservatives have aligned themselves with to be along the lines of the money changers?
Well, I think anybody who plans to make money off of death is cynically committed to what the scriptures call principalities and powers. And why we would politically align ourselves with that is deeply confusing to me. But I think a lot of money has been invested in convincing Christians of that, and so I don't want to wag my finger too much at other Christians, but rather I want to reach out to my sisters and brothers and say, listen, there's a better way, and we can in fact build alliances with people who want to work for the common good.
You write that as an evangelical who cut your teeth in politics during the heyday of the moral majority movement in the 80s. You know the enthusiasm many conservatives feel at the prospect of culture war victories at the Supreme Court. How do they believe they can win a culture war? And in fact, what does that really mean? We hear that term about the culture war. What does that mean?
Well, I think what happened after the 1960s was the anxiety that white people felt because they were losing power and control you know, in a society that had been dominated by white supremacy, many of those people who just assumed that culture associated their religious values with that culture. And so as they saw it passing away, and after the Civil Rights Movement, it was no longer allowable to be publicly racist. The religious right provided a way for people to talk about traditional values instead of white values, to frame it as their Christian faith instead of as their cultural and ethnic tradition. And that that I think has created a whole culture. I mean, people have lived in insular worlds where they've gone to Christian schools or they've been homeschooled. They've read, you know, books by David Barton that say this is and always was a Christian nation, and Barack Obama tried to take us away from that, but, you know, Trump is our savior and is going to bring us back. I mean, there are people who actually believe this because it's what they've been told, and they've lived in a world where that has been echoed and reinforced on Christian broadcasting and in the Christian literature that they read. And I think it's much like in the New Testament when Jesus comes and directly challenges the religious leaders of his day and says, "Look, you've sold out. You've bought into this system that is oppressing people, and you are covering up for those who are wolves." He said, "You're like wolves in sheep's clothing. You're deceiving people by using religion to cover up for exploitation." That's the situation we're in today, and I think it's important for people of faith to stand up and to say, because of their faith, that they're standing against this kind of exploitation. That's why I was so glad to see at the hearings last week my sister from Indiana, Alicia Wilson Baker, who spoke out and said she was a pro-life Christian. Somebody who does believe in life, you know, whole life, womb to tomb, everything. And that's why she was there to testify how the use of religious liberty that someone like Kavanaugh wants to defend in the courts actually prevented her from getting the kind of birth control that she needed in the state of Indiana.
In fact, that raises a very fundamental question for me that as I have engaged in this debate at various times with pro-life folks is, I believe you. I believe you 1,000%. I'm with you 1,000%. But what makes you think that you have the right to impose your belief into somebody else's household? Who anointed you or provided you with the authority to tell someone else how they're supposed to manage their lives? Just because that's your faith and that's your interpretation of the text doesn't necessarily mean that it's right for someone else.
Well, that's right. I mean, we live in a nation of laws, and I think it's incredibly important for people of faith to say that we respect equal protection under the law, right? So if someone's religious liberty is going to infringe on someone else's equal protection, I think in a, you know, in the society that we live in, we need to say that that's illegal. You can believe whatever you want to, but you can't use that to discriminate against someone else. That's a misuse of religious liberty, and it's one that's very common among the religious right today. It's actually one of the main lines of argument that they've been pursuing.
And it flies in the face of the fundamental premise and pretext of the Constitution. You write that you join many other faith leaders to oppose Kavanaugh, not in spite of your faith commitments, but because of them. How so?
Well, my faith commitment is to the Jesus I know, who says that he's come to make it possible for us to have life and to have life to the full. And I think that means that I, as a Christian living in this democratic society, need to build alliances and partnerships with any of my neighbors who want to build up the common good, and particularly to speak up for the concerns of those who are marginalized or made vulnerable by those in power. Right now, the people who are in power are at least pretending to be Christian, and so I find myself arguing with folks who are misusing my faith.
In fact, as we talk about the creation of the society, one of the things that I don't hear Christians talking about is the social contract theory. I think that was Thomas Hobbes, that in order for us to peacefully coexist and to avoid what he called the state of nature, then we have to relinquish some of our rights so that we all can peacefully coexist.
That seems to me to be the democratic experiment that we're living in. And I believe in it. I want to see it lived out because, I've seen its richness. I have Muslim neighbors and secular neighbors who right here in Durham are helping us be the kind of community that we want to be. And I want to be able to work together with them and not have this kind of nostalgic myth of a Christian past that politicians can exploit to call people back to. I think we've got to leave that behind. We have to have a moral vision of a multi-ethnic future where we're sharing life together and pursuing the common good.
You blew me away with this one. You're asking fellow believers to step back from the rhetoric of quote-unquote life to examine how decisions before the court would impact the vulnerable people who we Christians claim to care about, even the unborn. That's the point in the discussion very few so-called evangelicals can even get to. Talk about that, please.
It's incredibly important. You can't talk about a concern for the unborn without acknowledging that under the Obama administration, abortion rates dropped to the lowest they've been since Roe came into effect. And that is because women had access to contraception and health care. In addition to, I think, some anti-poverty programs that give people, more choice and flexibility in their lives. If you really care about life, and again, I do, from womb to end of life, I think life is incredibly important. But we can't pretend that prohibition has in any way made the unborn any safer. Prohibition in the early 20th century, was advocated by many conservatives who knew from experience, many of them living in poverty, that alcoholism wreaked havoc in families. But we learned as a country that prohibition was not going to get rid of alcoholism. And in the same way, prohibition of abortion isn't going to get rid of the very difficult circumstances in which people choose to terminate a pregnancy. The most important thing that we can do if we want to avoid unplanned or unwanted pregnancies is to give women access to the health care that they need.
What is it that you want the reader to walk away from your article having a clearer understanding of?
Well, I want people to know that the religious right doesn't speak for Christianity. I think especially, in these days when, President Trump is so allied with this extreme right and, has state dinner-like events where these, 100 or so white evangelical pastors that are always willing to speak for him come in and kind of rally that base. I think it's important for people to realize that group is still really only about 15% of Christians in this country. And if that's the case, then I think they're extremely overrepresented. And as a matter of fact, there are folks, like I mentioned in the article, Lisa Sharon Harper, who has led the call to pause. People within the evangelical community who are saying that we need to pause the culture wars and look again at this. In addition to that, there are lots of other Christians who are not part of that evangelical stream. Black folks and mainline folks and, other folks who have never really bought into this story. And I think it's incredibly important to recognize that there is a Christian faith that is about pursuing the common good.
Final point. You write, as proponents of Christian nationalism continue to be the most consistent base of support for President Trump, your evangelical faith compels you to challenge the way reactionary conservatives have hijacked your faith to serve their narrow interests. Man, I don't hear a lot of folks speaking that truth, and I'm so glad you wrote it.
Well, I hear it more and more, and I'm encouraged by the way that even within the evangelical community, by the way, younger evangelicals simply don't buy this narrow view of moral issues as just, abortion and prayer in schools. No, that was a very intentional narrowing of the moral vision of the Bible. And so, it's more and more the case, even among young evangelicals, that concern for immigrants, concern for the poor, concern for refugees, these are front and center issues that have everything to do with our faith. And I have hope that we can continue to lift up that moral vision and to join with other people of other traditions or of no faith who share that moral vision, because it's also at the heart of our Constitution. It's at the heart of many of our shared texts in this democratic society.
Pastor Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove, you direct the School for Conversion in Durham, North Carolina. You're the author of Reconstructing the Gospel, Finding Freedom from Slaveholder Religion. Thank you so much for coming to the Critical Hour.
Good to be with you. Bless you.
Thank you. Bless you too as well, sir. Be safe in that hurricane. Thank you. Well, you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Hey to folks on Facebook. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. You know, this is CBC Week in Washington, D.C. The Congressional Black Caucus was founded in 1971 to positively influence the course of events pertinent to African Americans and others of similar experience and situation, and achieving greater equity for persons of African descent in the design and content of domestic and international programs and services. They convene this week in September, come to Washington, D.C., hold conferences and do a whole number of networking and other types of exchanges. And my question now is, are they doing this today as an organization? For the answer to this, we turn to my next guest. She's an activist and co-producer with her husband, Abdu, of Lukman Nation. Jackie Lukman, welcome back, as always, to the Critical Hour.
Thank you so much for having me back on.
Now, there are a whole bunch of folks that I think are going to throw rocks at me when I leave the studio today for asking this question. Is the CBC Week and is the Congressional Black Caucus still relevant?
Well, they're going to throw rocks at me, too. So we'll be ducking rocks together.
You go out first, then. Spoken like a true man.
I looked at their schedule, and while I was really glad to see some things on their schedule, I was glad to see they have a session focusing on H.R. 40, which is Representative Conyers' bill to study reparations. I was really upset that it's only one session. Why is this not the overarching theme? Reparations and economic justice and intentional economic restructuring is not the right word, but economic reparations for Black people. Why is that not always the overarching theme of the CBC's legislative caucus? I don't get that.
Okay, now let me stop you there, because that is a perfect example of one of my big issues, which is, if you make that the recurring theme, then there should be a very clear agenda of how you bring that legislation to the floor and how you get an up or down vote on the legislation. Uh-huh. And as a result of the conference, people should leave the conference with an understanding, with a mission and a tactic and a strategy of, this is how we're going to do it. And we're going to come back next year and we're going to give an accounting of what we did in following that plan, so that we can then be better armed as we continue to go forward, making adjustments so that eventually we can be successful.
I agree. Part of the problem with just the discussion around reparations that we always have, we meaning Black activists and Black people in general, is that we always hear from everybody else, how are we going to implement reparations? So who's going to pay for it? How are we going to do it? How are we going to distribute them? Well, if the if the legislative body that is supposed to represent Black voters and Black and the Black constituency would focus on this and lay these plans out, because it's not difficult. This isn't rocket science. And as a matter of fact, my husband and I watched an archival video from the Depression era where I think it was FDR implemented in Illinois a $22 million relief package where they literally passed out checks to people.
Mm-hmm.
And there was video of the smiling, happy white people holding a check saying, well, wow, we really thank the president for this money. And I'm going to pay some bills, and if I have any left over, I'm gonna go on vacation. So the idea of the government providing some type of reparatory
remittance
to its citizens, remittance, whatever you want to call it, is not foreign. But if we had a legislative body that represented the Black constituency, that presented this information, presented the history, presented the facts, and presented the way forward to how we implement or realize this goal of economic and reparative justice for Black people, we could eliminate in a lot of places that ridiculous question of how are we going to do this.
But Jackie, you are missing, I think, a even more fundamental element. I'm a policy guy, okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so what I have seen with this particular conversation is the distraction of implementation before we can even get an understanding of the very fundamental premise of, is reparations or are reparations owed?
Mm-hmm.
That's the first point. And once we get a yes to that question, then we can move to, okay, what do we want and how do we get it?
I absolutely agree. And this is where my criticism of the CBC comes in.
There you go.
Them being, yeah, in regard to them being, I'm sorry, I'm going to say it, the two safe Negroes. That's how I see them now.
Right.
They are a far cry from Ron Dellum's vision.
Right.
And that's such a shame, because to answer this question of are reparations even needed, well, we had Charles Ogletree,
right,
who did this work, who laid this groundwork. Sadly, now we're losing his mind to Alzheimer's.
Right. We had Dr. Ron Walters on the team.
Exactly. But we still have NCOBRA, an organization that's dedicated its existence to the push for reparations for decades. So we have this brain trust out here that has the answers to the question, are reparations even needed? And all the CBC needed to do was every year keep inviting these people back.
Well, let me explain to you my theory of the two safe crew, and you can tell me if I'm on track.
Okay.
You mentioned Ron Dellums, and when you go back to the original members of the caucus, they all came out of the struggle. They weren't politicians when they got to the political positions. Most of them were organizers and activists who came out of the struggle. And they carried that mindset and mentality into the legislative process. Now, with the exception of a few like Maxine and a couple of others, most of them have no clue about the history and the struggle. And so their focus is playing it safe so they can be reelected. Hence, they're the two safe crew. Am I off base here?
No, you are right on track. And interestingly enough, this reminds me of something that Chokwe Lumumba said at Netroots, that instead of us allowing the establishment to present their choices to us of who should represent us, we need to send our representatives to them. We need to pick our representatives from among the people who are doing the work among the people for the people, and we need to send our representatives to them. And this is why, just like all of the other long-term congressmen who are sitting on 10 miles, less than 10 miles away from where we live and making bad decisions, that impact our lives because they are disconnected from the real world. These people know nothing about the real world. They are career politicians who get special perks and a lot of money for making the decisions they do, and we don't. They don't get that money from us. So we need to select people to replace them, yes, even the members of the CDC, with people who are more like Shirley Chisholm, with people who are more like Ron Dellums. And that includes being honest about the current efforts that they're doing right now. I mean, one of the most basic and it seems to me common sense problems with this CDC conference is the fact that the main sessions are held on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. We work. The Lukemans work for a living.
And work hard, by the way.
Well, thank you. We do. We work hard for our paycheck, and then we work twice as hard to talk about these things that impact our lives in every other way. But we can't attend these conferences because they're during the workday. So who are these people in the CDC trying to network with if the people who their policies are supposed to represent can't even participate in the discussion?
And I go back to a point I made earlier. There, to my knowledge, there are no metrics to determine success or failure of the previous year's conference. No. So pick three things this year. Three pieces of legislation that you want to impact, pass, or defeat, and set an agenda on how you're going to get that done. Send people out with marching orders. This takes me back to Ossie Davis, who was the keynote speaker at the first CBC conference dinner.
Uh-huh.
And the title of his speech, well, I believe this was, if this wasn't the title, this was the theme. Hey, man, what's the plan?
Right.
And he closed it by saying the organization should develop a plan so that if tragedy should befall us and there are very few of us left, the one who crawls out from the rubble turns to his brother and says, hey, man, what's the plan?
Exactly.
That's how he closed his keynote address at the first Congressional Black Caucus dinner.
Mm-hmm. And from looking at the schedule, I don't see a plan. I see some good ideas. I see some gems that they could frame a plan around, but I also see some serious problems in understanding why that plan isn't going to be implemented, because I think one of the major issues, it's great that they have a whole day dedicated to focusing on Africa. And I'm interested in finding out what that content is going to be. But they can't have an honest discussion about what's going on in Africa, in any country, in any context, if they're not going to talk about the expanding U.S. military presence in Africa, what's really going on there, why that's really happening, at the same time that they have two sessions where they're talking about how Black people can capitalize off of a better relationship with the Department of Defense and the Department of Homeland Security.
But Jackie, see, now you're asking African-American members of Congress to expose and then challenge empire.
Of course. I know. And that's why you're sending me out first. Cause
yeah. You saw that, huh? Damn.
Uh-huh.
I thought I could get that one by you. No, but I think that's a very, very serious, because, for example, people talk about Senator then President Barack Obama and for example, speaking at John McCain's funeral. And my point is, folks, you got to understand he's a functionary of the United States government.
Yes.
As a president of the United States, he's going to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, he was the last representative of the empire. That's
right.
What?
Right. So,
and then he furthered the mission of the empire,
because that's what the president of the empire does.
That's what they did. He didn't challenge it.
Not hardly, if at all. In fact, he, in many instances, was more Bush than Bush.
Yes.
So getting members of the CBC on the Africa issue to talk about AFRICOM and to talk about what its role is and to talk about, is that actually working to the benefit of the people on the continent? You're asking for some pretty strong folks to stand up and take some pretty bold positions. And I don't know that get along crew is that crew.
They're not that crew, which is why they're pretty much irrelevant now.
They're throwing boulders at you now. You are going out first. I'm going out the back.
I mean, in order for us to survive, not just in the metaphysical term, in this country, we are facing not just an economic crisis. We're facing a healthcare crisis. We're facing a mental health crisis among Black people in this country. Criminal justice,
education,
very existence, education. Our very existence is threatened to be almost, I won't say extinct, because it's not that. It is, we are being pushed to the point of an irrelevant population.
In fact, Samuel Yett, in his book, The Choice, told us all the dishes have been washed and put away, all the shoes have been shined, all the wood has been chopped, and the water has been hewn. We have become an irrelevant people.
Some other revolutionaries like Kwame Ture and other people, I think Malcolm X even noted, even back in the 60s and the 70s, that the concept of Black people being a surplus population. I think Dr. Jeremy Horn talked about that some too.
Right.
So this is a crisis we've been facing for a long time. And because the politicians who represent the Black constituency are not revolutionaries anymore, they don't see a need to challenge those issues that are
No, they're working on behalf of Big Pharma like Cory Booker.
Yes. So they get their fat paycheck, and that's all they're concerned about, just like most other politicians, which is why they need to go. I really do believe that if we're not going to have politicians who are working for us, in the halls of power, then why am I bothering? I'd rather you not be there, because I mean you're not doing any better or any worse than somebody else who doesn't claim to represent my interests.
I got to stop you there, Jackie Lukman. How do people get hip to Lukman Nation? How do they get their passport and get into Lukman Nation?
You can always find Lukman Nation by searching under LUKMANNATION on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. We do a live stream every Thursday night, usually most of the time, 8 or 9 o'clock.
Okay.
On YouTube.
Cool. And tell Abdu I said hello.
Thank you so much. I will.
And you go out first, and appreciate it. Hey, folks. You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all tomorrow right here on Radio Sputnik. Be safe, peace, and blessings. To those in North Carolina, we pray. I'm out.